afternoon. Today's high 80. Brand new numbers in. Wind from the west-southwest at 7. Still cloudy. Humidity 81%. Now 70 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago. He later served as station manager and as one of the hosts for the WGTD morning show.
And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about a really interesting and important project that is underway within Racine Unified, specifically at Case High School. And it involves Case High School's baseball field, which has a long, proud tradition, but which is in a really sad state of disrepair at the moment. And we're going to be talking today with two people who are involved in an effort to, in a sense, rehab the Case baseball field. First of all, the coach of the baseball team at Case High School, James Riccio, who also is a tech ed teacher at Case, and Sherry Krensky, who is really the driving force or one of several driving forces behind this effort to get some funds together and to have the Case baseball field brought back to its former state of glory, shall we say. And the big kickoff for what's going to be, of course, an extensive effort over the course of probably years will be happening on Sunday afternoon, August 27th. A huge day planned with all kinds of events. And again, that will just be the catalyst for all kinds of fundraising events that will follow thereafter. This is something that will not happen quickly, but it is something that they are determined to see come to fruition. So we're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about, first of all, the proud tradition of baseball at Case, but sort of the sad state of affairs in terms of the baseball field at the moment, and the hopes and dreams for what it can become. So Sherry Krensky and James Riccio, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Glad you're here. Glad you're here. Sherry, I think you are the one who kind of got this crazy idea together in the first place, although there's probably a whole lot of people, including Coach Riccio, who've kind of shared your dismay about the situation. So let's start first with what kind of prompted you to want to try to do something about Case High School's baseball field. Did it happen in an instant or just kind of over time? And what are the kinds of things you saw that sort of drove you to undertake this?
Well, for me, I've always tried to do community projects where when my son was at Gilmore, I helped over there. When he was at Gifford, I did a lot over at Gifford. So when my son started Case this year, I always like to drive around it because I graduated from there. It's kind of fun, you know, just to see what has changed, what hasn't. And I do remember even at open house, or I think it was when it was before open house, when they could go pick up schedules, we were walking around and we walked around out in the back where the fields are, because I used to, like I told you, play softball back there and saw the baseball field and just We were like, wow, this is horrible. So as school started, went on, you know, you would see all the other sports practicing on their field or, you know, track, you name it. And I started asking questions as it got closer to baseball season because it was pretty apparent they weren't going to be able to do anything out there. And I remember going to a parent meeting that James held where it got brought up about the field. Are we going to be able to play on it this year? So returning parents were asking about that. And he wasn't able to really provide much of an answer because from what I'm understanding from the questions I was asking after that, nobody would really be able to answer that.
Right. So it was a big, big question mark, but that says something about
what's
the state
gonna
of the
happen.
Field.
Right. What's going to happen with the field? So I started talking to him, started with, you know, since he's head coach, do you really know what's going to happen with it? And he said, you know, you really need to talk to the AD. So went and talked to him. The athletic director. Tried talking to him. And then I had worked with the buildings and grounds director, Brian Arnold, before on other projects. So I reached out to him because I really wasn't getting answers. And he had told me that was basically the breakthrough conversation, I think, because I had followed up with James after that, where he said, there's nothing on the budget. And unfortunately, we were too late for this year because their budget was already set.
Right. In terms of trying to do something immediately.
Exactly. Because it's not, they can't practice on it. They can't play on it. And that's when I learned, was it 1 year or 2 years prior, that a bunch of parents wrote letters to...
My first year. So not last year, the year before.
Okay. So, yeah, you could speak to that.
Yep. So I had parents write letters to the school board that had kids that played in the program currently and previously just to talk on, you know, how important it is to have a field at home and... pretty much, you know, making it apparent the state of our baseball field. And all of our kids were asked to have those turned into our current athletic or to the athletic director at that time to take to a board meeting. And my understanding is they were brought to the board meeting and they were brought up and nothing happened after that.
Right. Right. It just,
yep. So I kind of tag teamed off of that then saying, well, what happened? I mean, some of these letters indicate spectators getting hurt by balls coming through the fence, kids twisting, spraining ankles. I think an umpire even hurt himself at that time when they were attempting to try to play on the field. And, you know, nothing came of it. So that's when I finally said to Brian Arnold, you know, look, I've done this before where I've worked with the schools on community projects. Would it help?
So this is an effort to try to... bring along something which sort of sputtered and then didn't lead to anything.
Right.
And this is like striking the match a second time, and hopefully maybe with a slightly different idea. Coach Riccio, let's hear from you exactly what we're talking about when we're saying that the baseball field at Case is not what it once was. And you're somebody who played baseball at Case. It's your alma mater, and now you're back as its coach. So compare from then to now. What is the difference? What has happened to the baseball field that makes it unsafe to use, at least on a regular basis?
Sure. So when the field was originally put in, there wasn't any drainage put in. So whenever we get a rainstorm, you're looking at 5 days of water on the field. Now, there are ways to expedite getting the water off, which requires you to... you're pushing your topsoil, you're pushing that dirt to the edges of the field, which creates the lips. But if you need to get a game in, that's what has to happen. In addition to that, when the field is dragged, there are some things that haven't been done correctly. So we're running a drag, and it's pushing the dirt out. So it creates these pools where the water can kind of sit. Years of that, and then add that to, I want to say, our maintenance hasn't been able to even work on the field if we've got water on it, so it sits there and it doesn't get the attention that it needs. Makes it really hard to keep it playable, and over time that really just kind of snowballs and turned it into what it is.
Right.
So when I got it 2 years ago and I looked at the situation, it was beyond repair for what I could handle as a coach and a teacher to get out there with the shovel and a rake and try and fix it. It just wasn't something that was possible.
Right. And are we talking now about a baseball field in which the surface of it, in a sense, is not what it's supposed to be?
So
in other words, from all of this flooding and flowing and so on over the years, we probably have a really bumpy field that's just unsafe to run on. It's unsafe to do anything on, really.
You're hitting ground balls to our players. I can hit a ground ball to short, and it'll take a hop over to second base.
Wow.
So it's unpredictable.
Yeah.
And I have to say, looking at our statistics from last year, we didn't practice one time on that baseball field. And the year before we had, in our errors, I cut our errors in half.
By not practicing on the field.
Because knowing as a coach that it's hard for an infielder to get comfortable fielding a ground ball when they don't know where it's going to go, if you're going to take one in the teeth. And we couldn't get on it this year anyways. So I said, well, we practiced in the parking lot. We practiced in the field house. We practiced on softball fields in Sturtevant. Sturtevant Youth Baseball was excellent in helping us, acquire a field to at least get some work on. About halfway through our season, we had a person, Chance Celeste, helped us get a field over there with Mike Rosenbaum assisting him, so that we could get outside and get some practice. But up until then, we're practicing tennis courts and in the parking lot and back of Case, and it's really hard to get comfortable as a player, and it's hard to teach baseball when you don't have a baseball field to teach from.
Absolutely. So when you can't play a game on your field, where do you end up playing your games?
So we ended up playing most of our games at the opposing team's field. So we would play at Bradford for our home game,
in quotes.
Correct. And the challenge to that is when you have a home game at your field, you've got time to relax a little bit before the game starts. You can get out, take some batting practice. You can pregame appropriately to prepare for competition. When we're trying to figure out how we're going to get down to a game, whether it's buses or minivans, however we got to get there, it's kind of how it was last year. It makes it really challenging to have a set game plan and have your players ready to go mentally to compete. And
wow,
we played 17 out of 20 games on the road last year, and it's challenging. And our three games that weren't on the road were at Horlick Field, which is also – it's not home. So we're
right,
going and playing at a field that's – it's a neutral site. I'll put a positive swing on playing on the road all the time. We aren't afraid to play at anybody's home.
I was going to say, there's probably a silver lining in that your ball players probably learn something about –
absolutely.
It toughened them up as competitors.
We're scrappy. We're very hardy.
Right.
But having a home field would be the turning point for our program.
Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just going to say, from the parent perspective, it makes it very difficult to support your kid going out for baseball too, because for us, it was so difficult for you guys to even tell us, when would practice be? Where is practice going to be? And especially for us working parents that don't have kids that drive,
right,
I think that actually deters some of the kids trying out for the team too, because they know they're not going to be able to get that transportation to get to those, wherever the location is for practice.
Absolutely.
At that time. Same thing for the games. If they're always played on the go, it's very difficult to get your family even. They don't have the fans.
Right.
We're not able to get out to Kenosha at 4:30 in the afternoon. We're not able to get out.
Or not everybody can.
Right.
It just makes it a little bit harder and a little more frustrating.
Yeah, it's very sad for the kids too, because they don't get that fan base.
Right.
Right.
They see the other team's fan base all the time, and they're sitting there, oh, maybe mom's in the stands, or maybe grandma was able to make it, but...
Right. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you played softball for Case, you know what that feels like, and you were a baseball player at Case yourself, so
correct,
you know what that feels like to play on your own field.
Absolutely.
Right.
And
gives you that sense of pride that you can't get playing at somebody else's field.
Right.
Right.
Right. So what is it that you hope can be done with the field?
So originally when Sherry came and talked to me, she asked me what I wanted. And what I want and what I need are two different things. What I need is a playing surface that is safe, that fans can come and watch the game and not have to worry about getting hit with a foul ball through the backstop. Dugouts that are intact, and bullpens that function. So if we had all those things, I can run a baseball program on a field that's safe, that has the resources we need there. What I want is, I want Case to be elevated. I want it to, this should be the first thing you see driving in from the interstate, is this amazing complex that we have at our school, and not just for baseball, for all of our sports and for all of our kids at Case High School.
Right.
But you got to start somewhere, and I'm the baseball coach, so this is where my passion is.
Right.
I see us having lights. I see us having a, you know, functioning electronic scoreboard that we can host a sectional game at, that we can host camps and showcases at during the summer, and promote our brand in our community and let all the kids in Racine know that Case is a place you want to come to play baseball, go to school, get a great education, and have all of these resources available to you so that you can become a successful adult and a citizen in Racine. That's my goal for it, and that's my vision for the baseball program, and that's what we try and promote within our team culture, are all of these things.
So, Sherry, as someone who is experienced at getting things done within the school district, and I know has headed up some other projects, I can tell you have this very much, you know, kind of mapped out in terms of a healthy strategy. And part of that is to not try to rush this. I mean, to do it right, and doing it, understanding that it's going to take some time. In fact, although you have a son who's a gifted member of the baseball team, it's not at all certain that all of this will be done in time for him. He might very well graduate before all of this is done, or even any of this is done,
right.
And yet you want to do this. I think it's important for you to have a chance to say why.
Oh, well, you know, it's, I think I said why earlier, where I've chosen to work part-time. So then the extra time that I have, I can volunteer, because there's so many places in our community that need the help. So for me, I always try to find another project to be able to volunteer my time toward. So this just seems like the right project right now to be working on. It needs it, and we've got a great committee, a group of people that are really wanting to do this. I think we have a great plan where we, like James said, we know what we need, but our goal is to get to what we would really want.
Right.
So we're kind of going with like a Lego concept, where you've got your base. You know, if you think about the Legos, you got that flat green surface, and we're working with Buildings and Grounds, where we have that model built then, where each year, each time we get more money, we can keep adding on rather than having to take apart and redo, redo, redo.
Right. Let me ask, administratively, do you have full permission to go for this? I mean, I don't even know who has to give permission for something like that. I mean, I know you have at least some of the top administration at Case High School itself. Is this also something where it has to be okay with the school board, or do schools, in a sense, have enough autonomy that if you can find the money and you can make this happen, you're allowed to go ahead and do this?
Well, I think, we're a bit unique, since it sounds like this is one of the first times that we're trying to do a partnership volunteer committee. So the school board is aware, they are supporting it, the top administration supporting it also. I mean, Brian Arnold, Buildings and Grounds Director, is on our committee. So he's been, we each have our roles in on the committee, and his is to make sure that school board's kept up to date, you name it. So yeah, I would say we do have full support. We just have to be careful how we go about it.
Right. And again, it helps that you have the experience of having done projects at least roughly comparable of this before. So the big kickoff event for what is going to be a long, persistent process is going to be on Sunday, August 27th, and it looks like a spectacular day is planned, all kinds of things going on. Just sketch what that day is going to be like, Sunday, August 27th.
Well, James, you can kick off for the morning because you were able to partner up with Mount Pleasant.
So Mount Pleasant Police Department and the Fire Department are going to be hosting their annual softball game. I received a phone call, and Mount Pleasant Police Department reached out to me asking if there was a way they could help with a donation for our field project, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
Just to have, you know, people wanting to help our program. And coincidentally, they were going to schedule their softball game the same day as our alumni game. And they had asked me, well, would you be able to umpire our game and have a couple kids volunteer at the event? And I said, absolutely. When were you planning on having it? Well, August 27th. And I said, oh, really? What location? And he said, well, Haven Park. And I said, well, why don't we do this? Let's try and, you know, put it on the same day, and we'll drum up a bunch of support for your game with our community at Case and vice versa. So it ended up working out really well for both of us that we're able to plan this on the same day. So we're going to kick off with the softball game at 9:30. When their game ends, they're going to have a check presentation to Case Baseball, Building Winning Culture. And then after that, we'll probably have a little bit of a turnaround to get the field prepped for the Home Run Derby that will start at 1. And then after our Home Run Derbies, we're going to play the alumni game at 4. So the Home Run Derby is open to anybody 18 and older that thinks they can hit a baseball further than 275 feet. We're playing at a launch pad, so it's at Haven Park. You've got some really good opportunities to hit one out of the park.
Right.
And then the alumni game, we're working on getting a bunch of our past Case Baseball alumni to come out and see if they still have it a little bit. So myself included.
Right.
And a couple of the a couple of our assistant coaches are going to be playing, and we're reaching out to a bunch of friends that we played baseball with in high school.
Oh, fantastic.
Sounds like we're going to have quite a few people coming back for the event and kind of make it a, you know, a fun day to reconnect with some people that maybe we haven't seen in quite some time. So if this could be an annual event for us, I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, fantastic. And so people pay admission to get in? Is that the primary way of making money that day?
Yeah, we're asking for $5 for the whole day. And then I forgot what we... It's on there for the Home Run Derby. I think we said
$25
for anybody who wants to participate in it. And the alumni, any alumni who want to play, we're just hoping for a donation. Then we'll have concessions. We've got merchandise on sale. We've got a bunch of games set up for all the kids.
50-50 raffle, it looks like.
50-50 raffle. We'll have a bunch of mascots there. Mm. We have a live DJ. Actually, one of our Case Baseball players is a DJ.
Yeah.
So he'll be doing that the whole day. Every volunteer you see there is part of the Case Baseball family.
Cool.
So the kids and the families are doing all of the volunteering.
And I suppose once the 27th is done, you total up your tally, and then
we'll let you know how we do.
Right. And then you do another and another and another.
Yeah,
and
I already have. We'll be doing a 9-pin in December. We'll be the next indoor one.
Right.
So we're just gonna keep going at it. We're writing grants. We're soliciting businesses, and just fundraising. We're doing everything we can.
And I'm sure it means a lot to these young men on the baseball team that there's this group of adults who are working so hard on their behalf.
Absolutely.
Well, Sherry Krensky and James Riccio, we hope a lot of people are going to turn out on Sunday, August 27th for this huge kickoff to your fundraising event, your fundraising effort, I should say, because it's going to be much more than one event, but your effort to rehab the Case baseball field and make it something we can all be proud of once again. I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. We will continue to get out the word about this and other events coming up, and we wish you great success on the 27th and beyond.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In part two of today's morning show, we're going to be learning about a largely untold story from 9/11, courtesy of a fascinating new book called Dust to Deliverance, Untold Stories from the Maritime Evacuation on September 11th by Jessica DeLong. Most of us vividly remember those photographs and the film footage of thousands of New Yorkers fleeing Manhattan by walking out of it across bridges to the outer boroughs. Most of us know nothing of the hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who were safely evacuated out of Lower Manhattan by boat. That is the story told in this very, very interesting new book, again called Dust to Deliverance by Jessica DeLong. In this excerpt from our interview, you'll hear Jessica DeLong describing that dramatic moment on 9/11 when the harbor was shut down.
This is a really, really tricky situation. First off, the economic pressure, as I said, to make that decision was huge. And the VTS, so the quickest way to explain what VTS is, it's a vessel tracking service, which operates very similar to what people think of as air traffic control for airplanes. So basically, this is an organization, an offshoot of the Coast Guard, a department in the Coast Guard, that is monitoring all commercial traffic in the port. So they have cameras all over the port. That is, they're doing visual monitoring, but then they also have computerized systems, identification systems. And these computer screens can show them what vessels are in the port, what vessels are approaching, and the specific, like lots of specific details, identifying details about the different vessels that become really important, because we're not talking about canoes or kayaks or even little, you know, motorboats. These are huge, huge vessels. And that means that their maneuverability is seriously restricted, first off. And second off, it means that if you tell these boats to stop, they can't just put on their brakes. They have to go somewhere. So whether that's out at anchorage, or if that's pulling into a pier or a dock somewhere, the parameters for who can go where are really constrained. And so these VTS officers were scrambling to try to offer what assistance they could and information they could for large vessels, large commercial vessels, cargo vessels, and otherwise. They're used to just transiting through. They're not, there's no idea that they're going to stop, you know, somewhere near Manhattan Island all of a sudden. And so you can try to shut down the port. And certainly the one of the first things that happened was that the VTS contacted the Sandy Hook pilots to shut down any additional traffic into the port. So basically those are vessels that are still out at sea, and there's a lot more in the way of choices for what they can do. Try to get fewer people, fewer vessels in this contained space. But they really had to scramble to try to find places that could accommodate such large vessels. And the other challenge was that the Coast Guard needed to make sure that they didn't impede the evacuation that had started literally within minutes after the first plane hit. And people don't realize, certainly many of us remember that the first plane was construed as an accident for a lot of people. But even after that first plane hit, you had ferry captains who were realizing that the PATH trains were going to be shut down. That's basically it's a train that goes in tunnels under the Hudson River, and so it was going to be complicated to run that with this accident, even if it was an accident. And so immediately ferry captains made sure that they had the boat that they needed online, and they started evacuating passengers. At that point, it was sort of like an expanded ferry service.
Right. And so what you're saying is this shutdown of the commercial port that's just one side of the story, and that shutdown needed to be done in such a way that it was not going to impede or eliminate this important evacuation operation that we're going to talk about in a second. Both things are happening in a sense simultaneously. You write, radio traffic exploded. The VTS team was besieged with calls as they struggled to guide the pilots, mates, and masters of vessels of all shapes, sizes, and configurations towards safe berthing and mooring locations throughout the harbor. And as you're saying, these are vessels that would not be accustomed to having to do this, especially unexpectedly. And the people having to do the arranging of this have never, ever had to do something quite like this probably in all of their lives, and certainly not to this scale.
Absolutely. The shutdown was unprecedented. I mean, it was really the good news is that we had the advantage, or the VTS had the advantage of a lot of information that wouldn't have been the case some years earlier, where they had this AIS, this identification system, which actually instantaneously they could, you know, punch a couple buttons and they could learn the overall length of the vessel and the draft, so how much water the vessel would need to have to be able to maneuver into. So there were some advantages technologically that helped facilitate that. But exactly as you said, there needed to be a way to shut down the port to any unnecessary traffic while at the same time not inhibiting this maritime evacuation.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking to Jessica DuLong. We're talking about her book called Dust to Deliverance, Untold Stories from the Maritime Evacuation on September 11th. Everybody remembers that on 9/11, all air traffic was shut down when it was not clear just how many of these hijackings were planned to occur. And so our skies were emptied. What just now we've been talking about is how the harbor outside of Manhattan, lower Manhattan, was also shut down on 9/11. But the really major story, which we will explore now, is the evacuation that occurred. Hundreds of thousands of people had to evacuate lower Manhattan. And although some of them walked, many of them were actually evacuated via the water. And that's something that we just didn't see or hear about at the time. One thing, Jessica DeLong, you say very early on in the book is that many of the civilians, as soon as this happened, as you say, from the time of even that first plane hit, which at that point was not evidently a terrorist attack. Of course, that's exactly what it was, but no one knew that until the second plane. But even after just that initial plane, there were already people desperate to leave Manhattan, and many of them fleeing to the water's edge, since the World Trade Center was so close to the water's edge. You write, "Never was it clearer that Manhattan is an island." Can you spell out exactly what you mean by that and the ways in which that was so very true on the morning of 9/11?
Absolutely. It really was just such a striking example of how geography matters in disasters. And we see that again and again with other disasters that we've confronted. From the, as you say, the World Trade Center is located very close to the water. And I would say while most of us assumed that the first plane hitting was an accident, there were some people who were immediately triggered and ready to get out as quickly as possible. And those were folks who had been working in the World Trade Center during the 1993 bombing. And they knew, they had experienced how vulnerable they were being so high up that many of them, their first instinct was to get out. And that happened immediately. Of course, as the cascade of events evolved over that morning, everything just gets worse and worse and worse. And just the danger and the horror magnifies. And what it is definitely true that many people walked over the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge, for example. But what a lot of people don't realize is that, especially as we get to the point of towers coming down and the entire area becoming blanketed with dust, people ran. And if you ran in some directions, you wound up trapped. You basically, there was no other way off other than by boat. And it's remarkable to me that given all that we have talked about with September 11th and all of the news coverage and so many anniversaries having come and gone, that we haven't quite processed this. And it becomes really, really important when you think about disasters on a larger scale. You think about, you know, what happened in New York City with Sandy, the hurricane, things like that. So what was happening in that morning was that people were winding up running whichever way they could, many of them running to the water's edge because they hoped to find air because they were breathing in something that was not breathable. It was solid mass that was choking them. And they went as far as they could. Many people jumped into the water. And I recount an just incredibly harrowing story by one individual who ended up doing that, making that choice to jump, really having no idea how perilous the currents are in New York Harbor at that place. There were untold numbers of water rescues that morning with ferry captains and other vessels taking full advantage of their monthly training for man overboard drills.
So you're not talking here about the people who were escorted onto boats. You're talking about rescuing people out of the water. I mean,
absolutely.
People who otherwise would have drowned.
Yes, and one ferry captain who I talk about in the book, he recounted a story where a man had several stories. One was there was a man who was barely holding on to some moss-covered piling. So if you can imagine this ripping current, and he's trying to cling to this very slimy surface, and he was losing his grip when this ferry captain pulled his boat in and was able to rescue this man aboard. Meanwhile, he also recounted this other story of a man who essentially was going out to sea. He just got pulled out into the main channel of the harbor and was headed out to sea when another ferry came and rescued him. That's the level of panic that people had. And I think it's hard because it's an adaptive thing for us humans to remember horrific events at a distance, you know, and I think that we've gotten so much distance from September 11th, and in a lot of ways that's a good thing, but there's an important story here, and the important story is that when terrible things are happening, there our default as humans, when it doesn't get messed up with other situations, our default as humans is to help each other. That's what we do, and that's what the Mariners did that day. They stepped up. There was no hesitation. There was no stop and think, oh, well, I'm going to help these people and not those people. None of that. And this message of humanity and kindness and resourcefulness and just this resounding human goodness that was on display that day, I really think is the most important part of this story.
I quite agree. One interesting observation you make, and it might seem relatively minor compared to a lot of the dramatic stories you tell, but I think it's a really important point that you make. We should say that your book not only tells this big story, but many smaller stories of individuals piloting boats, individuals fleeing this disaster. And I really appreciate how your book is telling the story on, in a sense, on both of those levels. One of the people specifically that we follow is a law student by the name of Gina LaPlaca, LaPlaca, and she makes a really important observation as she's heading towards the World Trade Center when all of this goes off. She steps back, you know, wondering what in the world happened. It's only when she goes a few blocks that she can gather around where someone is listening to the radio, a small group of people, and they start hearing sort of what happened. And she says, it was odd the way information flowed. The closer you were to it, the less you knew what happened. And I've heard that said before, but she says that especially well. I mean, in a very few words, she really helps explain one of the most sort of bewildering things about what happened on 9/11 in terms of how people experienced it. That if you were some distance away, and especially if you were watching television, you still didn't know everything, but you knew much more than those who were caught right in the middle of it.
It's absolutely true, and it is one of the really painful parts of unpacking this story is how the communication failures and information, the lack of information was deadly in a profound way. And a perfect example of how awful that was is the fact that firefighters, first responders, and others in the remaining tower did not know that the first tower had fallen until later. They were in the other tower, and they did not know that the tower had fallen. There were sources who had been in the collapse of the first tower who didn't realize that that's what they'd been hit by and sort of wandered away in the dust and didn't even know that the tower had come down. They thought that they'd been caught in explosions or something like that. So, the communications issue was just really devastating. The fact that the failure of the fire department radios accounted for so many people killed that day. The other element here is that the dispatchers in the fire department, and this is where, you know, getting too deep into the research, it can be really upsetting, obviously, that the dispatchers were giving people misinformation because they didn't have proper information. You have people who are in such a vulnerable situation in these towers that are just raging with fire that is just completely out of control, that firefighters, they realize very, very early on that they are not going to be fighting these fires. This is a rescue mission only. They are completely incapable of fighting the fires that have reached this level, just based on physics and like water capacity, and the destruction that had happened to the towers. So you have people in the towers calling loved ones, asking them to, you know, turn on the television and give them some advice about what they should do. And dear God, may that never happen to us in this country again.
Absolutely. So it is an interesting case of how something happened and it seems as though absolutely nobody was prepared for it. And that is not said in any kind of critical way as criticism, but simply as fact. Nothing like this had ever happened before, and nothing exactly like this had ever even been conceived by us. And so on so many levels, the way in which we reacted to this revealed that no one could imagine such a thing ever being done, and particularly being done on this scale. One of the things that you say about that is this: in the face of this massive incident, the shared purpose and common ties that connect mariners of all types ruled the day as the different agencies cooperated with civilian boat crews. As it turned out, the lack of a plan wound up setting the stage for creative problem solving and improvisation. Throughout this historic morning, the New York Harbor community joined forces to carry out an unprecedented and remarkably successful evacuation effort. There's a lot there. And I want to get quickly to the matter of improvisation and how that was, in a sense, the predominant theme of the day. But first, I want you to talk a little more about why you describe this as the New York Harbor community. I think that is a really great way to describe the wide variation when we're talking about all of the vessels in this harbor. And then we better appreciate, I think, the remarkable way in which they came together in a common purpose. Describe more about that New York Harbor community and all of these different mariners.
Definitely. There are several different threads here that I think are important. One is just for folks who don't spend time on the water and who aren't professional mariners, it's important to recognize the fact that built into the structure, into the very, very fabric of being a seafarer or a mariner of any type, a sailor, there is sort of encoded in you from a very early moment the fact that you come to the aid of those in peril. And this makes a lot of sense when you think about it, because people out at sea, you would want someone to come for you, right? So everybody has that that guiding principle, which is that if somebody is in need, you step up. And it's so encoded that it's actually a part of maritime law that you must, if you are not going to be putting your, simply put, and you know, not in legal language, but basically if you're not going to put yourself and your boat and your crew in harm's way by doing it and magnifying the damage, obviously, that you're required to go and help. So that's one piece of what's going on here. It's important to note with that, however, that this was not a maritime event, so to speak. So this, what was happening, the devastation that was happening, was on land. The people who were being rescued and evacuated were on land, other than the people who were in the water, who we spoke about earlier. So technically speaking, this doesn't fall under the Admiralty law kind of category. However, that principle is so ingrained, it's just so knee-jerk, such a gut-level response, that mariners very quickly just set course straight for, as things escalated further on, the dust. They came from places where they were completely safe, completely removed, and they shot straight for the disaster, straight for the most dangerous spot that they could conceive of on the planet. And they did this because that impulse is so deeply ingrained. That's one reason. And because my argument is that humans, we actually do that. That is what we do, is we help. That's our default setting. The other piece here is specific to New York Harbor, which is that this is a really, really complicated waterway because it is constantly struggling between its need to be a commercial port, right, which is very important, and this resurgence of recreational activity that's now happening now that the water is cleaner. There are so many kayakers and all different kinds of other recreational vessels that make use of these waterways. And so it can be tricky business figuring out how to accommodate these very, very different kinds of vessels with very different needs. One of the things that happened in New York Harbor that was really in just played a huge role in how things unfolded that day was something called the Harbor Ops Committee, which was basically bringing together commercial interests and basically stakeholders of all sorts, Coast Guard, ferry captains, you name it, anybody who had something going on in the port of New York, New Jersey. They came together for regular meetings to brainstorm and troubleshoot how to work together to make sure that there was a collaboration happening, that everybody could work together and use these waterways. So those relationships that were established prior to that morning, so these are relationships that exist on September 10th, 2001, they played a big role in how things unfolded that morning on the 11th. Because when people were trying to seek out, okay, I need to speak with somebody in the Coast Guard, I know this guy, I've been to meetings with this guy. Or the Sandy Hook pilots who I mentioned earlier, who are the ones who literally lead ships into the port every day, the big commercial ships. So these relationships were pre-existing. The other thing is, even in a less formal way, people knew each other from the radio. You know, they had their, and a lot of times it's, you know, like rivalries between companies, and there's that, you know, if you picture like rival sports teams, they like, you know, they ride each other a little bit and things like that. But in that moment, there was no rivalry. This was just get it done. How do we get it done? Let's all share resources. Let's figure it out. Let's figure out the most efficient way, the safest way. You know, what do you know that I need to know? What do you have that I need to have? And everybody, to the extent of literally taking fuel bucket by bucket out of different tugboats' fuel reserves because there was a need for diesel. It's remarkable the number of details, and really that came from a place, well, as I said, the need to help that is ingrained in humans and deeply ingrained in mariners, and then also these existing relationships that were really pulled together in that moment.
We're speaking with Jessica DeLong about her wonderful book, Dust to Deliverance, Untold Stories from the Maritime Evacuation on September 11th. This is a largely untold story indeed of this massive evacuation. Hundreds of thousands of people safely evacuated from Lower Manhattan on 9/11. We're not talking about the people who walked out of Manhattan. We are talking about the people who were evacuated from Manhattan via boats, boats of all different sizes and shapes and purposes. Ahead of us, Jessica, of talking about a couple of specific people and specific stories, I want to find out from you logistically how in the world you were able to gather all of these stories together. I can't even conceive of it that you were able to connect with all of these different people and collect all of these varied stories, dramatic stories from that day. How did you set about doing this?
That's a very good question. It's a tricky answer. It was a daunting proposition, to be sure. I think in this case as well, community played a really big part. And I asked everybody I could think of. I posted on Facebook. I posted on my website. I spoke with people in my community and just said, hey, who do you know? What do you know? What can you tell me? Who should I speak to next? And so that really was the sort of trickle out. What was so amazing and so gratifying through this process, as you can imagine, I'm walking with people through some of the most horrific and harrowing days of their entire lives. And that took a toll. And the generosity of sources, many of whom, or at least some of whom, never told their story to anybody except their closest family until they shared their story with me. And that should paint a picture of the gravity of the process of telling that story and how it can really stir things up for people. So the generosity that they, the fact that they shared their stories is, it will, I'm getting a little emotional just talking about it because it was incredibly generous of them to do that, because this is history. This is our history, and we need to take account of these things so that we can be prepared in the future. One of the elements that was so gratifying, though, was that when I would speak with this person, they would know that person who would know that person. And what I found was I was finding multiple sources within the same story. So, for example, Fireboat John D. McKean, which was an active duty fireboat that day, ended up being the nexus for the interaction between all of these various individuals who I found separately and interviewed separately about their occasions, and they all wind up on this particular boat. And so that was just amazing to be able to put those stories together. Or, for example, one source who ended up being evacuated by a whale boat, a very, an open launch vessel, very low to the water,